So, you know, when I was in my early 20s, when you leave a relationship, you do your best to leave it well. Because how you leave a relationship is going to exactly mirror how you're going to enter your next relationship. Just remember that. That's a little piece of excellence right there. So if you're going to leave in a place where you leave the door open, you're not going to be available for your next one. If you're going to leave in a place of real ugliness and vengeance and spite, that's the way you're going to enter into your next one, because life actually is a mirror. Okay, and it reflects back to us. There's a law, and its name is the law of reflection. It reflects back to us what we put out. Okay, so when I left my very first girlfriend after 3 years in what I can only call was hell would be a good description. 3 years, probably 2 years and 11 months and, you know, 2 weeks longer than I should have been there. I left and I was so grateful to leave. However, I left and I really, really left well, with gratitude and with peace. I had supported her. I had given her the time and the money and the emotional support to go get the PhD, that elusive, you know, all but PhD that you have like forever. When I left, it was still all but PhD, but I had done everything I could do in the relationship, was as generous as I knew how to be, so much so I ended up in Al-Anon. They have a name for it, enabling. And I left thinking, okay, you know what? I really am so glad to go. I am glad that I had this experience, meaning I will never do this again, ever in my life. And 3 weeks after that, my parents called our house, in which, of course, we had, you know, two bedrooms, because it was at that time, and everybody's living in the closet. We had two bedrooms, one real bedroom and one fake bedroom. So you have to pay for a two bedroom, even though you know you're not using it for anything. And I certainly didn't need an office to myself at that time. My parents called and said, is she there? Because I hadn't told them I moved out. And she said, no, she's not. And by the way, she's gay. I know. Thank you. That was my feeling exactly. It was like they didn't even ask you for that. Why are you giving them information? Don't ask, don't tell, right? So she told them I was gay. So of course, just out of nowhere, and she did that because she knew that was the one thing that I just would never have done to my parents. My parents are, you know, not from this country. And they're like, think of like your grandparents, you know, from Italy or something. Those are my parents. They're very, very traditional, old fashioned. So I got a call. And my mom said, you know, would you come home? Just, you know, we just like to talk. And I thought, hey, okay, because my secret was still good with me. So I went home, we sat down at the kitchen table, my dad got up and he said, I'm going for a walk. Right? So we're sitting at the kitchen table having coffee and mom says these exact words. You know when you hit a crisis in your life, you like remember what you're wearing, you remember what they're wearing, you remember the bird tweeting outdoors, you remember everything about that moment, because that moment is about to become a moment in your life that is a game changer, okay? So you're going to remember every little detail. So she says this line exactly. She says, we know. Right? Like this, we know. And I said, you know. You know, you rise up and your eyes rise up and they're supposed to fill in the blank. She goes, we know that you're a woman who likes women. And this was a huge, huge secret. My parents were not equipped to handle this information the way these days parents, they march in a parade down Fifth Avenue saying, I'm proud that my child is gay, right? In PFLAG. Whatever the opposite of that parent is, okay, on another planet in a parallel universe is my parents. And my mom said, we know that you're one who likes women. I thought, oh my God, maybe a miracle has happened. Maybe all of this pushing stuff down that I had done all this weight I was carrying, pushing down, all these cigarettes I was smoking, trying to push down this secret that kept pushing back, trying to emerge. Maybe it's all over. And I jumped at the chance to get out of jail free. I jumped at the chance to get out of jail free. And I said, oh my God, yes, I am. And she said, what? Right? In her whole little Jewish life, she had never bluffed me out. She'd never given me a head fake, ever. And this was a head fake moment. She was bluffing. And I fell right into it, and she freaked. And we began speaking about it until my dad came back from his walk, right? His walk, and the first words out of his mouth was, well, is it true? He says to my mother, and my mother says, it's true. And therein began a Greek epic moment, right? Of such horrific proportion that all of my worst nightmares about what your worst fears are when you come out to the people you love most as the person you are. And that moment could not have been worse than my worst dream about it. There were things that were said there that should not have been said. Because once you say certain things, you don't erase them. And that was the moment where I learned in anger or in upset or in crisis, no words will ever pass my mouth that are said in anger with a mean spirit designed to hurt. Because to this day, I remember the entire conversation as it happened. And those things shouldn't have been said, but they were said. What happens in a moment like that is you are on one side of an argument and somebody else is on the other side. And sometimes it's your parents. In my case, it was my parents and my dad mostly. And or it could be the person you're living with or your boyfriend, your girlfriend, your cousin, your sister, your boss, your neighbor, whoever it is. On the other side of the room, on the other side, they and you do something together. You each bend down and pick up a rope, right? You each pick up your side, and my side is, I am right. My side is, hey, I didn't make myself this way. I've been this way since I'm 5 years old. How can you blame me for something I am? It's not a choice. It's just who I am. And if I am this, I can't understand why you think I'm doing this to you. I'm not doing this to anybody. If I had the choice in this world, in this particular world, I would have chosen an easier route. Man, I would have chosen to be a handsome white man, for God's sakes, right? Or a fabulous, great-looking black gay man or something. Or a gorgeous blonde woman who was straight, who was like bees to honey, who had her choice of anybody she wanted to be with. Rather than being gay in a family where being gay was tantamount to, there was nothing beneath being gay in the list of things that were the horror in my family. It was the worst. There is nothing worse. Prostitution doesn't even come close. Drug addict prostitute, doesn't even come close. This was the worst of the worst. And they, my parents, picked up the other side of the rope. How could you do this to us? We are right. Because this was our worst fear, that you would be different and your differentness would be visible. Right? So you're picking up a rope, they're picking up a rope, and you're both right. See, there's a problem with this. You're both right. From their point of view, all they asked for in making it through the war in Europe was like a normal, nice girl, a nice girl. Somebody like Carol. She's a very nice girl. She's quiet. She's obedient. She listens. You know, she was a nice girl. Right? I never shut up. When my dad said, when we were like 12 years old and we were moving from Maryland to New York, my dad gave us all the choice, myself and my brothers. We were all in private school. And he said, you know, we're about to move, so I'm going to give you your choice now. If you want to continue in daily, this has been our whole life, daily Hebrew private schools, which meant, you know, 8 to 1 was with rabbis in shiny black coats, and the afternoon you learn some English, do you want to continue in private school, Hebrew private school, do you want to go to a regular public school? It was like, oh, hello, no brainer. I am like so out of here. It was the wrong answer. Yet another trick question, right? I thought we actually had a choice. The problem is we are both right, because they didn't deserve to have the kind of child that was absolutely so out of the box that they could not put it back in the box or hide it in the box, because you can't. Because it's what you are. It's who you are. It's not just who you prefer to be with. It's a part of your identity. That is the nature of what it is. And we were at odds until the conversation was complete, and the conversation ended with me. It's a beautiful tradition in the Jewish religion to mourn the death of your living child when she doesn't live up to your expectations. So it was like, you can no longer come into this house, and we will mourn your death. You don't exist. It's a lovely tradition handed down from generation to generation, and rightly so. It's very effective. So I was no longer allowed to come in the house. I'm not telling this story to say poor me, although I can accept any sympathy you wish to give me, right? It's a good story. God knows I milked it for like ever, right? Still talking about it, right? But now people pay me to hear this story, right? Before you could hear it for free. Now you actually have to pay money. So I could no longer go back in the house, which wouldn't have been a problem if I was me now. If I was me now, I could have handled it. I had the skills. I had the tools. I am now more courageous, more brave. I've been in the world. I know how to write a check. I know how to do things. At that time, I led a very sheltered life. We all did. We were very sheltered. Because all my parents had in the world after they lost everybody in Europe were their 3 kids and a relative or two. When I watch on television those families that have, like, you know, 13 grandkids and 7 brothers, these pictures, our family pictures were always like just us. They were just a little group of people. So we were it, and their hopes and dreams were upon the 3 children they had. And I got that. I got what their dreams were and how I did not fit into what their dreams were. He was right. And I was right. And I left. And I left my job, and I left my apartment, and I left town, and I moved away. It was easier to just move away and begin a new life. So why do I bring this up? When we are injured in our lives, and everybody has been, everybody's got a story. Everybody has got a story. When we are injured in our life, Carl Jung, the great psychologist, says, when we are injured in our life, there is no way to heal from that injury unless you tell the absolute truth. Okay? It's an interesting piece of advice. And the absolute truth, as I understood it at that point in my life, in my early 20s, was, look what you did to me. Look what they did to me. And you know what? Through the body's eyes, they did do this to me. And it made a really good story. And I went into shock, and I couldn't speak for a while, and I was so depressed, and I was in such darkness, and I had to go get help and support. And that the beginning of just entering the world of therapy and figuring things out and telling your story, all of that had yet to happen. All I knew was that something happened to me. And I, at that time, would get so pissed off, as many of us would, When you hear things like the teacher, the master teacher, Jesus saying, oh, love your enemies. And it's like, yeah, okay. Okay, right? He was never disowned from his family. He disowned his family. Nobody disowned him. So maybe his idea of an enemy was different than my idea or our idea, because what happened to us never happened to him. And yet the Tao Te Ching says the same thing. Listen, verse 69, interesting number, right? There is no greater misfortune than feeling I have an enemy. There's no greater misfortune than feeling. Look at that word and put that word away somewhere. Tuck it away for a moment, because it doesn't say there's no greater misfortune than having an enemy. That's a different statement. It says there's no greater misfortune than feeling that I have an enemy. Right, the Tao Te Ching is 81 verses long. Some verses are like one line. It is just a short, little, tiny book on the philosophy of life. So I am sure that Lao Tzu, as legend tells us, is the person who wrote it. And I'm sure it was written by a number of people over the years. But if indeed Lao Tzu, the old man, wrote it, as we are told by legend he did, you know he picked his words carefully. Carefully. And they didn't have thesauruses back then, so we had to think really hard. What is it I exactly want to say in the exact meaning? Listen, there's no greater misfortune. Greater misfortune. You would think greater misfortune, cutting off a leg and you're a runner. Losing somebody you love when you finally opened your heart and you began to love somebody and boom, they were gone like in Magnificent Obsession, right? Where she loses her husband, 1950s, Rock Hudson's breakthrough movie. Just everybody's like, who? Right? Is that a Harry Potter thing? So there's no greater misfortune than feeling I have an enemy. For when I and enemy exist together, there's no room left for my treasure. Okay? There's no room left for my treasure. Here we are pulling on two sides of the rope, and I'm telling you, you couldn't have talked me out of the position of I am right, because I was right. I didn't do anything wrong. I was just being myself. I didn't even want to tell them for this reason. I would have kept this secret to my grave. I would have kept the secret to my grave even if I smoked a million cigarettes to keep it inside of myself from coming out. We don't go into addiction unless we are hiding a part of our nature that is a part of our destiny that we're afraid when it comes out, we're going to lose people over. Addiction is a very smart hiding place, and we're very smart people when it comes to survival. Okay? So the Tao says this. It says, there's no room left for my treasure. Thus, when two opponents meet, the one without an enemy, will surely triumph, which means I got to put down my side of the rope, because as long as I'm holding the rope, there's no room for my treasure. Now, what does that mean, treasure? It doesn't say there's no room for my peace of mind. It doesn't say there's no room for, you know, being able to rest easy or to be happy or to have a nice day. It says treasure. It says there's no room for my treasure. Now, an interesting thing is, here's the Old Testament. Here now is a statement from the Bible. It says, when you are coming to the altar to present your gift, whatever it is, and what that means to us is when you're turning to the source of life in prayer, with a prayer for something you really want or would love to have, or a desire in your heart that means so much to you, something you want to do, something you want to have, something you want to be, something you want to do for other people. When you turn to the source of life itself, don't get hung up on the word, what the altar means, the old-fashioned, Old Testament way. The altar is the place when you go to a sacred space inside of yourself and put your deepest wish out. Here's what you're told. You're told to go and find the brother that you are angry at, that you haven't forgiven, and go make friends with him. Make friends with him. And then, after you've done that, then you can go back to the altar, and then you can present your gift there. What is it saying? It's saying, when you want to go higher, when you want to go deeper, when you want to align yourself with the source of life, when you want to align, for those of you who might use the word God, when you want to align with the divine, when you want to come into oneness and center yourself, the spirit of enmity puts you out of alignment with spirit. The spirit of enmity, the spirit of hatred, the spirit of I'm right and you're wrong, that feeling, no matter how right you are, that feeling, even if you are in the right, that feeling puts you immediately out of alignment with your ability to present your desire, your wish, your need on the altar, the sacred altar. Forget an altar, an actual altar like they did in the old days. The altar is our own self. It's our own mind. It's our own consciousness. We put our wish out, our desire out, and we're told, don't do it now because you will not be able to make the kind of contact and feel the oneness. You will not be able to receive what it is you are wishing for. You will not be able to give in the spirit of free giving because a part of you is stuck, is locked. Your hands are closed in a fist around the side of the rope. And we say, give me, we say that, give me this. But our hands, you'll notice, holding a rope or in fists. And even if life wanted to give to us, it couldn't, because our hands are in two fists holding a rope in our rightness. Right? This is why the Course in Miracles says, do you want to be righty? Do you want to be happy? And you would think those two things would be in the same sentence at all. But when we are holding on to our rightness, we are holding on to the end of the rope, and we might be right. I was right. He was right. And I didn't have a piece of mind from that moment forward in my rightness because my hands were already utilized, fisted up around a rope against someone who was against me. So why in the world should we present a gift at the altar? Why waste our time? Why waste our energy? Hell, why waste our gift? Right? In the old days, you gave the gift of like a sheep. Why waste the sheep's life? Why waste our time offering something that we're not open to receive? Hear that. It's so important because we say, well, I'm just not getting it. And what this is saying, you're not getting it. It would love to be given to you. Ask and ye shall receive. What I learned in the science of mind was that the universe never says no to us. The no is an echo that is coming from within our own consciousness. How in the world can we receive when our hands are busy, occupied, utilized, full of a tug of war that's been going on, not today. See, we don't even see the fisted hands because it's not going on today consciously. We think, well, that was 10 years ago. But 10 years ago doesn't mean a thing inside our body, because there is a place in our body that is on pause in that moment of time and has not, because it cannot move forward. It cannot move past that place in time. And that place in time, I had an enemy, and the enemy happened to be the people closest to me. Right? Now, how do you get out of that jam? That's a jam. Because I can't receive the riches of life. We can't receive what we ask for. We can't give and receive freely because we are occupied with enmity. And the spirit of enmity is not in alignment with the spirit. Why? Because the spirit of enmity is closed. It's closed. It's closed in a fist size. So our heart becomes the size of a fist. So when Jung says, when you have been injured, and man, that was an injury, and it happened at a most unusual time because three weeks before, I'm the person who had my hand up and said, "Woo, get me out of this private school, please, save me." And I entered into public school. I absolutely did, went right into public school and ran in the opposite direction of my religious upbringing, because my religious upbringing was all about fear. That's what was taught to me. And you know what? I did not feel safe in those teachings. Didn't work for me. It might work for others. It didn't work for me. Not the way I was raised and taught about what life and God is. Didn't work for me. However, at 22, 23, I had an experience, my very own direct experience of the source of life. And in that moment, I turned back, not to my childhood teachings. I turned back to the source of life, realizing I'd thrown the baby out with the bathwater. It wasn't the source of life I had issues with. It was the way in which it was presented to me as the infallible truth. I learned I could have a direct experience with the source of life that was my own, that was as real as everybody sitting in this room and me speaking, so real, so alive, so present. And on that day, I knew my life had changed. And 3 weeks later, I had this conversation with my parents. Right? You enter this path, you think, oh my gosh, I have had a legitimate spiritual awakening. Only good shit's gonna be happening now. Right? I'm gonna get the job I want. I'm gonna get the girl I want. I'm gonna lose all this weight off my body. I'm gonna fit into all this good clothes. I'm gonna get the apartment I want. I'm gonna have the friends that I want. I'm gonna have the car that I want. I'm gonna have the money that I want. Everybody's gonna love me. I'm gonna love myself. I mean, the list is a laundry list of the best things in the world. And 3 weeks later, my parents booted me out of the family, right? 3 weeks later, I had a skill that I didn't have 3 weeks before, which was I knew I wasn't alone when this happened. That's the only thing I had. I knew I wasn't alone because 3 weeks before an experience happened to me, and I felt the power and the presence in me, around me, and beyond me, and it was real. It was real. So I wasn't alone. But here's the thing. Carl Jung says, in order to heal from an injury, your rejection, your disappointment, your abuse, in order to heal from it, we have to tell the absolute truth. Well, you know what? I told the absolute truth about this story about 5,000 times to anybody who would listen. You're not going to believe what happened to me. You're not going to believe what, my name is August. You're not going to believe what happened to me. It's the opening story. If you want to know who I am, let me tell you the injury. Here's the thing. Here's what he says, and watch the words again. Because anybody who is a good teacher will be very careful with the words they use. He said, in order to heal from an injury, you have to tell the absolute truth. Which is a very different thing than the truth I was telling, because I was telling the truth, and I was telling the whole truth about what happened to me, what happened to me, what was done to me, the injury done to me in the world of effects. Meaning, if you look with your eyes at what has happened, it sure looks when you're injured as if what has happened to you. And who wants to put down their end of the rope when they're right? I mean, you'll put it down eventually if you're wrong because you're ashamed. People are saying, you still carrying that thing around? Get over that. But you're right. Nobody's going to tell you to put it down if you're right. The absolute truth. Now, here's the funny thing. In Ernest Holmes' teaching, Ernest Holmes, the man who started that movement of thought called Science of Mind, not Scientology, Science of Mind. Science of Mind is a compilation, Eastern and Western, of all the teachings that revolve around the one truth, the set of truths that underlie all teachings, all religions, and all philosophies. And in his teachings, he calls one of the names for God, for life, in the Tao Te Ching, they call life or God, they call it the Tao, the way, capital W. Who can argue with way? Who's going to argue with the word way? Right? As a minister, I rarely tell people I'm a minister, because when they say, what do? You're a minister. It's, oh, man. And they begin with their childhood religion, and it's all your fault, because your part is like, oh, no, I'm not that kind of a minister. Too late, because you already have reverend in front of your name, so I usually say just August Gold, right? Who can argue with the word the way? The way is lovely. There's no charge with the way. And he had a word, he had a series of words, what he called the source of life, and one of them was the absolute. The absolute, meaning that which is not changed, that which remains unchanged no matter what. Here in this world of 10,000 things, everything's relative. But this absolute, the absolute truth is that which is true regardless of what appearance might tell you otherwise. Right? We have to tell the absolute truth in order to heal from our injury. Absolute. And here's the thing about the absolute truth. That story is a very different story than what happened to me. You want to know how I know this is true? Because I told my story 5,000 times. I have heard people's stories 5,000 times. There are people in this room who have paid money to their therapist for so long, their therapists have houses out in East Hampton, right? And they have heard, your therapists have heard these stories, have bought beautiful property in East Hampton, listening to the stories of what happened to you. And you're still locked into that place. That's the problem with a story that's true, factually, but not absolute. And here is how you know the difference. You can tell your story over and 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 over. Wake up tomorrow morning, nothing's changed. You have not moved on. The rope, you still got rope burns, right? On your hands, going back and forth from something that happened a decade, 2 decades, 3 decades, 4 decades ago, and you're right. You want to be right or happy? You know what? As soon as these people come to me and ask for forgiveness, right? Carol and I have a thing in our home that if somebody has done something really wrong, the way in which you ask for forgiveness is very different than just, oh, I'm sorry, babe. Oh, I'm sorry, babe does not cut it when you've been very bad, right? I'm sorry, babe is nice, you know, if you did the toothpaste wrong or you left a light on or the car's running, but I'm sorry, babe doesn't begin to heal the injury you feel that somebody did to you that you love who loves you. That's a special kind of thing. For that, you get down on your knees. And you have to say, I'm sorry in French. Right? Because English, anybody can speak English, right? But French is different. Je suis, on your knees. Je suis. We could say it together.
I want to hear it.
Je suis très désolé. Oh, right? And if you've been very bad, it's vraiment, vraiment, which means very, very désolé. Okay? So even in our house, in order to put down the rope, you got to speak in French on your knees and say it with such passion. And you got to do it in French with the guttural things in the back of your throat, which is not easy for a wasp, right? To get to those rolling R things in the back of your throat. So it takes some effort. For a Jew who speaks that way anyway, the vraiment, vraiment, just it rolls right out. You know? Not for a wasp. Right? We'll let down the side of the rope, man, when we get them to say, I'm sorry. And here's the thing. We're waiting for them to say the I'm sorry, and that is not going to either happen, or that is not, if it happens, going to free you. And we need to really get that, because that's not where the freedom is. We're still in jail, even if that happens. Here's where the freedom comes. And it's in the word, it's in Young's word, absolute. Right? John Keats has a poem. He says, if you look at life rightly as a world of soul making, you will know what the world is used for. right? If you see the world rightly as a world, a veil of soul making, that there's a deeper story going on, and it's the story of your soul. It's a larger story, a deeper story, a greater story. We talk about it week after week, week after week, a deeper story. In the deeper story, through the eyes of your soul, and don't get hung up on the word soul. Soul is just the deepest part of us. If I am the I, my personality, then the deepest part of me that knows and knows that it knows, that can see through different, deeper eyes than my human eyes, my body's eyes, that's the part of me that's connected to all people, all things, the oneness that every path talks about. That part of me is called the I am. It's the I am part of me, the I am part of us, the soul in us that knows, we know, we, this is us, we know that what has happened to me has happened for me. And you know what? With our eyes and our body, on my best day, I couldn't see how what happened to me happened for me. We can't see it. And if we keep telling the story of what happened to me, even if we tell it eight zillion times, it's still not going to free us. We're still going to be in the same place, stuck, holding on to the rope with two hands that are fists so that love can't come in. Treasure can't work in, come in. What does the Tao say? You can't have your treasure. When you feel you have an enemy, there is no room. Look at a fist. There's no room for it to come in. So we say, oh, I don't want to be all spiritual forgiving people. I'm not that type of a person, or that's not important right now. I need to get a job, or that's not important. I need to fall in love. Here's what the Tao says. Anywhere in your consciousness, if you and enemy exist together, there is no room for your treasure. Your treasure of love, your treasure of money, your treasure of happiness, your treasure of peace, your treasure of destiny, your treasure of place. Why? Because there is no room in your two fists that are being occupied holding a rope of rightness, right? So we go down to the place. Here's what absolute means. It means you go to the place within you, your soul. You go to the place within you, your divine intuition. It's a breath deeper than you ordinarily go. In 21 years of doing work at the level of the soul, there isn't anybody that can't go down to this place. You're designed to access this deeper place. And why is it important to go to the level of the soul so you can know the secret of the Himalayan mountains? I don't think so. To figure out how the stars are hung in the sky and what the Big Bang really happened? Those things aren't important at this moment. At this moment, my fists are so tight, I can't get at my treasure. And my treasure is my happy life. And it's infecting, these two fists are infecting everything. I'm closed. Mary Oliver calls it the little dark acorn of your heart. You become so tight inside. You become so cynical, and we'll call it by many different names. You become depressed. You become angry. You become jaded. You become cynical. You become bored. You begin to look at the world through these tight eyes, thinking the world is just shit. Because that's all you can see through the peephole of your fist. You go down to the level of the soul, and here is why you must. Here is why it is not optional not to go down to the level of your soul. If the story, your injury, can only be seen through your human eyes 20 years later as what happened to you, which Jung says will never be healed. Never. That means not today, and that means not never. You go down to the level of the soul so you can see the same story of what happened to you and how it happened for you. Only at the level of the soul, only at the level of your deeper mind, only at the level of the deeper you, this you is wired into you. Everybody has this place in them to go deeper. It is so easy to access, it's ridiculous. It is a few breaths deeper than you ordinarily go. It's not hypnosis, not anything special. We don't light incense and put on special music and flick the lights and wear a robe. None of that happens. What happens is you take a few breaths deeper, and what you're doing is you are accessing the place in you that has eyes of the absolute. The Bible will call them the eyes of God. Let me see myself as God sees me. Let me see this situation through absolute eyes, through the eyes of the absolute. And here is what I saw. I saw my dad. And I saw him very clear as day. And I said, why did you disown me? That's the whole question I had, right? All these years later, I had one question. I just was reeling from that body blow. I needed the answer to that because I didn't heal, because I couldn't heal. And he said these exact words. And this is inside of you. This is inside of you. Understand, this is inside of you. You're not going to read a book by a famous special psychic who can see to the other side and then tell you what you need to know. It's in you. It's in you. We have access to this place. This is in our power to do. And it doesn't even require power. It requires your ability to sit your tachas on a seat and be silent for a few moments and turn within to access the place in you of absolute, capital A, trust, a truth. And this is what he said. These exact words. I didn't disown you. These exact words. I didn't disown you. I pushed you out of the nest. And all of a sudden, I saw an image of the mother bird that pushes her babies out of the nest, what appears to be prematurely, because they don't know they can fly. If you ever have seen little birds, and we have them out our windows because we live in the country and have for a while, well, country, we live in the country. We live, you know, an hour outside of New York, but we got a lot of trees. So when you've lived in New York 30 years, any time you see a tree, it's, oh, I'm in the country. So, right? So we have trees around our house, and we see what that is. And the mother bird, these gawky little, and they're so ugly. They're beautiful in their ugliness, but they're just so ugly and gawky and wet and weird looking. And they don't know they can fly. They don't even know what these big flippers are. They have no idea what they are. And the mother bird one day instinctually pushes them out at the moment that she knows it's time for them to fly and pushes them out of the nest. And that's what my dad was saying to me. He said, I pushed you out of the nest. Like, what are you even talking about disowning? What does that word even mean? That isn't even a correct word in this situation. We didn't disown you. We pushed you out of the nest. And we pushed you out of the nest because had I not pushed you out of the nest, your mother never would. And you never would have left. And if you would have known me then, you would have known how true that was. I had the opportunity to go away to college if I wanted to, but I didn't take it because I was too scared, because that's who I was back then. I wouldn't have left. I would have moved right next door or down the street or a drive away or in the basement. I'd have been 300 pounds pushing that secret down. And I would have taken my parents' proposition, which they offered me in the kitchen on that day they disowned me, which is, let's make a deal. And the deal is, if you will be a normal person and get married and have a child so the community can see that you're normal, you can then get divorced, and then you can be whoever you want to be. And we'll give you a car. Right? It's true. We'll buy you a house and give you a car to sweeten the deal. Deal sweetened. Right? Right? So, in my generation, a third of people who were gay ended up, you know, dead by their own hand. And I understand why that would be, because that was a horrible choice. And I might have been a scared little mouse, but I was not scared enough to take that proposition. And what my dad was saying was, you'd never leave, and he was right. I couldn't even go to college. How could I go away and do my destiny and become who I was destined to be? Never would have happened. How could I have done what I needed to do? How could I have gone to school to become the minister I needed to be? Hello, Jew, be a minister. I wasn't going to a school to become a rabbi. At least they could explain, okay, she's a female rabbi. It's a little weird. I was going to be a minister, and then I was going to open a church. The whole thing was wrong from the beginning, right? I wouldn't have done any of these things. My trajectory of my destiny was so in opposition and outside of their box, it was preposterous. And he said, you never would have left, you never would have gone. And he was absolutely, absolutely 1,000% correct. I had to be pushed out of the house in order to be free of having to worry about hurting anybody or protecting anybody from who I was, so I could just be whoever I was supposed to be. And whoever I was supposed to be was down such an interesting, funky road. It surprised me. It surprised me. So the interesting thing was, at that moment when they told me that information, you would think, when you see that, when your soul shows you what happened to you happened for you, look at this. All of a sudden, from that day forward, I can't tell a story of what happened to me. I can't look at this injury in the same way. That's why radical forgiveness will tell us, Colin Tipping will tell us, until you get to thank you, you haven't forgiven. Because if you're in the place of, well, they didn't know any better, they didn't know what they were doing, that is not forgiveness, right? That is not forgiveness. Forgiveness, to know all, is to see all, the Christian mystics tell us. To know all is to understand all. To know all is to forgive all. And yet, why was I still holding that rope, even though now, through the absolute truthful eyes of my own soul? Why? Because I had a decision to make. It is one thing to see your story absolutely true, but now you got a decision to make. Are you willing to put the rope down? That's an actual decision we have to make. Are you willing to put the rope down? Sometimes the answer is no. No, really. Because you know what? Ah, this feels so good and passionate. This gives me something to do. This gives me someone to hate. I can actually get a lot of power out of this. I can get a lot of pity out of this. I can get a lot of attention out of this. Who wants to put down the rope and have empty hands and not know what life is going to fill these hands with? Right? We got to consider that. So in my heart, I had to make the decision to put down the rope. And how I saw it in my mind, because I did a second soul session. You don't do sessions if you do sessions on everybody else but yourself. You do them on yourself first. You take yourself to the place of, okay, I want to put the rope down and I haven't. Help me to put the rope down. Help to free me. You know what forgiveness feels like? It feels like not waiting for anything. Forgiveness feels like not wanting anything from anybody. Forgiveness feels like you are free to move on. So when people say, how do you know you forgave? If you have to ask, you haven't, right? You know, because you're free to move on. You're not waiting for anything, you're not wanting. And I wanted that. And even though I saw the story rightly, I had to make the decision to put down the rope. And how I imagined it was that there was a part of me sitting by a window with a lit candle waiting for my parents to come and undo the harm they had done and give me the love I deserved, whether I was gay or not. And love me the way a child should be loved. And at that moment, I understood that's not going to happen. I got it. It's not going to happen because it's not supposed to happen. It's not going to happen because I was pushed out of the nest, just like a bird is pushed out of the nest to learn how to fly. Because he already knew on some deep level, not a personality level, on a soul level, that that was his job to provide for me. He needed to do that for me. We're not talking personalities, not the story level, the effect, the level of cause, the soul, the deeper story, the soul story, why you're here, and all the people who are here to help you. This is the only reason Jesus could say, love your enemies. It is the only reason the Tao could say, when I have the feeling I have an enemy, there's no room for your treasure. It's the only way the Bible could say, put your gift down and go make friends with your brother. Why? Because you're not free to receive anything. You're occupied with enmity. And you're so closed. I was so closed, I couldn't fly. My destiny did not begin until that day I made the decision, oh my God, I got to put the rope down. I have to put the rope down. Whether he did or not is irrelevant. We have to put the rope down, not for them, for us, so that we can be free and have our hands open. What does it say? Go and make friends with your brother, and then, look what it says, then come back. Then come back. Come on. Come back to the altar. Bring me your gift. Come on. Make it happen. Tell me what you desire. Tell me what you want. What do you love? What do you need? Come back after your hands are open. It's not about being a good person. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with being real. That is the major difference between the religious path and the spiritual path. Religion is about being good. And you know what? I was as good a girl as I could be growing up. The spiritual path is about being real, telling the absolute truth about who you are and what happened to you, because therein lies your freedom. I put the rope down, but I couldn't have put the rope down and kept it down and left it down with freedom, with ease, not asking my parents to be on their knees speaking French to me, coming back on their knees. And they couldn't. They could speak Yiddish, right? But they couldn't speak French on their knees. I didn't want anything. I didn't need anything. I wasn't waiting for anything. I was free to move on because I had seen that what happened to me happened for me. And only the eyes of the absolute, only the eyes of your soul, only your deeper eyes will tell you and show you that story. And when you see that story, man, you don't have to ask a million times, how do I forgive? It takes you to forgiveness. That's the soul's job. Every time you go down to your soul, I'm telling you, it takes you to the place of absolute truth, which leads you on a path to forgiveness. Why? Because the Course in Miracles says this line, forgiveness will offer you everything you want. Everything you want, you can have through the act of forgiveness. Because what is the act of forgiveness? The act of forgiveness is opening your hands and putting down the rope so that you're free and open to give and free and open to receive. This is not an empty promise. This is psychologically sound. It's spiritually sound. It's emotionally sound. Through the doors of forgiveness, we then put down the rope. Doesn't matter who else is holding it, because it takes two for the tug of war. Once your side is down, it's over. It's over for you. And you cannot put it down with all your best self-willed efforts until you know and see with your own eyes how what happened to you, the injury you sustained, happened for you. That place, those eyes reside in you. That ability to be free resides in you. That work, you can do it, resides in you. Those answers resides in you. That larger story waits for you. It's all in you, and it is all waiting for you to put down the rope in all areas of your life to anyone you're holding the rope up against, so that your hands are open to receive. As the Tao Te Ching says, now you have room enough to receive your treasure. Listen. Thus, when two opponents meet, the one without an enemy will surely triumph. Enough said.